Yeah, there is a degeneration of of these like social categories. There is a destructive element that capitalism plays in ripping up the material basis of these static, eternal forms of, or what we're taken to be anyway, these static, eternal forms of social life that all human social existence must find itself contained within. They're not wrong.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Thank you for joining us. I'm really excited about our conversation today. My name is Vanessa Wills, and I'm here with a set of wonderful speakers to talk about transgender Marxism. And this event is sponsored by Spectre Journal and Haymarket Books, and we thank Haymarket for their collaboration with us. Spectre Journal is a biannual journal of Marxist analysis, theory, and politics, and we also publish online at spectrejournal.com. We highly recommend that, especially if you enjoy the conversation that we're going to have here today. We have conversations like this all the time in print, online, and in our journal, and we encourage you to come check us out and maybe even subscribe to our journal and donate if you want to support these kinds of events and reflections. So today's event is called Transgender Marxism Against the Backlash, and the right has launched a systematic backlash against trans people. It has introduced hundreds of anti-trans bills in state houses across the U.S., ramped up attacks on trans people around the world in courts and legal systems, and waged a campaign of escalating vigilante violence. Now's the time for analyzing why the right is focused on trans people as primary targets of class war from above. Now is the time for organized efforts at building broad solidarity with trans people to fight back. So we're happy that you're here to join frontline trans theorists and activists for this discussion of how transgender Marxism can explain the backlash and help guide the resistance. Helping our efforts today are we have John McDonald and Carlos Enriquez, who are helping us with our tech and are keeping everything running smoothly so that we can just have this conversation. And our speakers are Jules Gleason, who is a writer, comedian, and all-around communist menace. Her work has been featured in publications and live events worldwide. And she was an editor of the volume Transgender Marxism and is currently writing her own book on intersex liberation's origin story in the 1990s. Sandow Sandy Sinai is a writer, musician, teacher, and communist living in Brooklyn, New York. She loves the bass guitar, psychoanalysis, and the dialectic. Danielle Cade Doyle Griffiths-Dengani is a writer and anthropologist teaching at Brooklyn College and the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. He is an editor of Spectre Journal and has also written for The Nation, In These Times, and Historical Materialism. And then you have me. I'll be chairing the conversation. I'm no longer assistant professor of philosophy. I'm very recently associate professor of philosophy at the George Washington University, and I specialize in moral, social, and political philosophy, 19th century German philosophy, and the philosophy of race. I have a book called Marx's Ethical Vision, forthcoming from Oxford University Press. And with that, I will get us rolling. So I want to open the conversation with a kind of an open-ended question that I hope each of you will respond to, which is the question raised by our sort of framing, our frame for the conversation, which is why in your view are these attacks on trans people happening, and why is this such a central flashpoint for the far right attacks on working people right now? So I just want to open us up with that question, and I'll start with Juliana.
Hi.
Okay. Hello.
So this is the pressing question at the moment. So why has the far right come to focus on transgender people, transgenderism, or whatever you want to call it, as its main focus in recent years? I think I don't know, really. But one thing to observe historically is that the right wing has entered a sort of dynamic and a rather fascinating and heterogeneous phase over the past few years in ways that I think probably most people can't help but have noticed. When I say it's heterogeneous, I suppose like peaking around 2016, the far right was notably insurgent, but also I would say very bifurcated. It was especially divided around the topic of Judaism and anti-Semitism and kind of conspiratorial theories thereof. And I think what was especially striking about the far right, but usually not observed so clearly, is that the division in the far right at that point in time was between explicit and more sublimated anti-Semitism. So you had figures who were talking about globalists while still vehemently supporting the state of Israel, including much of the leadership of the Israeli state itself. And then you had more kind of like overt, active, kind of worldview anti-Semites who were primarily advancing that position first and foremost. And of course, we saw a group of them marching in their chinos on the capital of Virginia and so on. But these moves to kind of attempt to explicate anti-Semitism were rather unsuccessful, I would say. And we saw that the force of the state following on from anti-fascist efforts kind of coming down to at least push the people who were involved in that march out of their jobs and so on. So the reason I'm starting off by talking about transphobia by addressing anti-Semitism is that I think there's a sort of like interchangeable move that sort of happens somewhere along the line where clearly explicit like anti-Semitic politics in the United States is something of a non-starter, at least for those who want to sort of attach themselves to an electoral project. So I would say that like the far right has instead sort of latched onto another target, which was always sort of present in a latent way. So if any of you want to like think about this in sort of some more theoretical detail, there's a very interesting essay by Naomi Eliza Cohen, who has written this essay called The Dread of Talmudic Abstractions, where she sort of goes into the longer history of this overlap between the trans woman and anti-Semitism as a figure. But we can see this in all kinds of like scholarship and literature on the topic. But I guess this sort of preamble and sort of analogizing move may not be satisfying to people, so maybe we can pass on to someone else. But that's sort of where I would start. I think it's mostly within the far right's sort of need for personification of mm-hmm. of capital and its sort of inability so far to sort of metastasize that around Jewish people, and the sort of interchangeable two-step that it's doing to sort of move towards at this point trans people. Now, some would say that it's moving from like anti-Semitism specifically to trans misogyny, but I think it's again a little bit more complicated than that. There's kind of another bifurcation which is arising there. But anyway, that's probably enough to get people started. So I'm about to pass on.
I think it's a great place to start. It's fascinating, and also I think speaks to some of the cynicism of these attacks. So Sandy, would you like to go next? I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, I mean, and Jules, as you know, I deeply, deeply love that Naomi Eliza Cohen article. I reference it all the time.
I reference it all the time.
I love that. And then also, I think one thing, you know, in kind of separating out the analogy, actually, and looking at what's different with trans people, I think one particular area that we have to think about a lot is we have to think of the children in a way that we don't quite have to, I mean, I guess we do have to think of children in the case of the anti-Semitic example in the blood libel kind of way. But that's even contemporary anti-Semitism. I mean, the QAnon is definitely doing some blood libel, but it's not quite the central focus because a lot of it is more abstracted from that. But with trans people, we really have to think of the children in terms of a few things, right? In terms of how all of those children are getting their genders, right? How all those children are getting their genders and understanding their genders and learning about the world of genders that exists. Capitalism really needs some specific genders to exist and gets very stressed out when other ones start cropping up. So that's a part of it. And that's one reason that you see it so, you know, particularly focused in the U.S., particularly on schools, right? There's all the don't say gay type legislation. And then also all of that segues into, like, labor control and labor discipline of teachers. Right. We're controlling what teachers are allowed to say and using the trans misogynist or the transphobic broadly and homophobic grooming bogeyman. Right. Against teachers is very effective at, like, suppressing teachers unions. Not least because it's very effective at suppressing gay teachers who are really good at organizing. I know Cade has quite a bit to say about that.
Yeah, thank you, Cade.
Yeah, I mean, I think looking at that, this question maybe from less from the perspective of, like, ideological consistency or a progression, and more from the kind of conjunctural moment. I think one of the things that is interesting, if unpleasant, to observe over the last several years, really since, in fact, the book Transgender Marxism came out, that period, is really how and when this particular kind and intensity of transphobia has been consolidated in different times and places. And of course, you know, at that time, this was most intense, I think, in the UK, right? And it hadn't quite arrived in the US at the level of coherence and intensity that it has. And it has since then become much more of the central focus of the right-wing backlash here. And I think why the difference between those two, that little time delay, is useful for thinking about what it is about this particular moment of the conjuncture that has consolidated that kind of emergent focus on trans people as the kind of central agenda of the far right. And there's a couple things. One is, I think, what Sandy was alluding to in talking about following, right, like a big, not just a kind of strike wave in U.S. public schools a few years back, but also the moment of the pandemic, right, where teachers and parents, both in a kind of organized fashion and also, I think, in a kind of much more organic and ad hoc way, but parents and teachers and students really were the people that shut down schools and thereby shut down most businesses during the period in which anything was shut down in the U.S. for the pandemic. And this kind of bipartisan effort to reopen schools and thus reopen the economy and reopen the world of profit making necessarily targeted teachers' unions and really specifically targeted that kind of shared interest between parents and teachers and students. And you know, through that targeted us, Sandy was saying, teachers unions and activists. In fact, you know, my essay in Jules' edited volume, you know, it's now quite old, but is in fact very much on the topic of why. On the topic of why it might be strategic, right, to target trans and queer teachers specifically as a way of targeting both actual and possible solidarity, I think, between parents and teachers and students. And so that does get us to, I think, the kind of practicalities, right? And this isn't just the far right. This is also, that was Biden's main agenda upon arriving in office, right, was to reopen the schools. And that meant putting down the teachers and teachers. In a certain way, the far right has done his dirty work for him in that sense, or been the kind of, you know, front line of ideological attack, but maybe not the total force of reaction, right? Maybe not even the main force of reaction in that sense. But it gets us to exactly, I think also both Sandy and Jules mentioned or alluded to this, really also the kind of core question for the far right, which is the family, right? The importance of the family to a kind of fascist worldview as the sort of central zone of autonomy, patriarchal autonomy and control. And there's a specific thing, I think, about trans people that locates us as a target when you look at it through that perspective of fascist ideology, right? That is distinct from the kind of anti-Semitic focus in some ways, which is to say trans people raise questions about the naturalness of the family, raise questions about the goodness of the family as the moral goodness of the family, as the site of the production of good and moral citizens, in reliable, inconsistent, unpredictable ways, right? By targeting, right, trans people, and especially trans people working in schools, for example, it raises a kind of conflict between the school and the family as who should have the authority, the state and the family, who should have the authority over the moral and educational message that we're sending children or raising children in. So that's I think one reason. And really, finally, the pandemic itself, right, really consolidated the conspiracy theory as the kind of model of far right thinking, and it raised that from, I think, a much more fringe kind of but already existent trend into a very dominant one in terms of how people on the right, and not just the far right, think about the world, right? Sort of made explicit that implicit conspiracism that's always present, I think, in right-wing ideology.
Great. I mean, there's a number of questions, I think, that are raised by that round of comments. And I mean, one of them is just about gender and capitalism. And I want to ask this in a couple different ways. And one is to follow up on Sandy's point about capitalism's reliance and dependence on a particular system of gender and its antipathy towards anything that threatens that. And Sandy, you raised that in the course of your comments. I'd love to hear you say more about that and hear from Juliana and Kate as well. And another question that I have related to that is, to what extent, I mean, when we talk about fascism, oftentimes fascism is grounded in the petite bourgeoisie, right? In these kinds of like precarious, not in the sense of being about to be homeless, right? Not in the sort of way we usually think about real precarity, but precarious in terms of constantly, they might lose their businesses, right? And sink into the proletariat, you know, Kellerohr. It seems to me that some of the hatred that is directed at children, right? Like it's presented as being directed at, you know, quote unquote groomers or, you know, this or that, right? But the most intimate, like most constant recipients of that hatred are children in the homes of these people. And I know there's some research, like I know there's been research done on Mumsnet, the British message board that helped kind of create a kind of incubator for a lot of anti-trans sentiment, and sort of moderately affluent people are overrepresented, right, as contributors to Mumsnet. And so there's this like connection to the family, both as this site of capitalist reproduction, but also as a way of performing a certain kind of middle class respectability that then your trans kid is messing up for you, right? And then this kind of this like class hostility that comes out in that way. So I have this kind of combined question, right, about this basically like capitalism and gender, but also not just big capital, but this kind of like anxiety about how do I perform this middle class respectability when my family doesn't perform gender in these socially prescribed ways. And so Sandy, I'll start with you if that's all right, or whoever wants to sort of get in first. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll jump in. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to chew on there. Mm-hmm. A couple of thoughts that I have, and really sort of speaking to why capitalism needs these genders. But one part of it is that capitalism specifically needs to control these genders. And I actually want to like do a little like orthodox Freudianism there a little bit, where what does it mean to to control and prescribe an identity, and particularly a gendered identity, right, is about controlling. It's about also about relationship to sexuality, right, and desire across similarity and difference, right. And through that, like, I mean, the classic Freudism point, right, of that work is some concept of, you know, sublimation of libido. And there's a lot that happens there. But there's another part of sort of prescribing these specific genders, right? But these specific genders, that is about, it's about class, but as you're alluding to with Mumsnet, right, with the English petty bourgeoisie, right? In fact, the step in between class and gender really is race very heavily. And so to that regard, right, how do you reproduce class relations intergenerationally? You reproduce them as race, right? That that has this biologically defined signifier class. And then how do you reproduce race intergenerationally is in fact very heavily through gender, right? And through the cultural differences and the differences in family organization between Black genders and white genders, right? And in fact, I think it's really no coincidence that the places in the United States that are most heavily doing the anti-trans backlash right now, right, are Florida and Texas, which, as Cade loves to talk about, are both on the Gulf Coast, the most miscegenated part of the United States, right? The part of the United States where the white people are most, have the most Black ancestry. And it's very, it's difficult in those circumstances, actually, to preserve race, which you have to do, because then how are we going to know what class it is? What class everyone is, right? So, so the reproduction of these sort of specific genders is very critical to that project. And it's also important with that to understand this, to take this sort of this step beyond feminism, as feminism is usually understood, right? To take this the step beyond that, to say that, like, white cishet women's genders are also very, very implicated. As part of both the system of control of queer people's genders and also of Black people's genders and lives. And I said a lot of things. Cade or Jules, do you want to pick up from me?
Yeah.
I just want to add one quick sort of concrete note is, one of the things you notice about the particular bills, the anti-trans backlash, and there are like over 500, I think, that have now been introduced, 550 or something, have been introduced in state houses and in the federal sphere in the U.S. There's a range of different kinds, but there's some of them that are really quite interesting along the lines that Sandy is talking about, some specific ones. And to me, the ones that are the most kind of personally and politically horrifying include, right, you know, the initial bill in Texas that not only kind of criminalized parental acceptance of transgenders, a thing which, as Jules always points out, remains pretty rare in the scheme of things, but also, in fact, deputized everybody in Texas as kind of reporters, as deputy police social workers, whose job it is to identify this very tiny minority of parents who are supportive of trans people, trans children's genders. That has a certain kind of structure that reminds us, I think, of many different things, but including the structure of Jim Crow and legal slavery in the same part of the U.S., right? Similarly, in Florida, one of the bills that was introduced, in fact, raised the idea that you could bring charges against a trans-accepting parent or just a trans person who is a parent, one might assume, in Florida against people who do not live in Florida. So a kind of Dred Scott structure of anti-trans hatred, and one that, if it was to be enforced anyway, has that kind of potential for conflict between the legal apparatus of different states in a way that kind of very much resurrects that north-south divide in the U.S., or the structural divide in the U.S. You know, I don't know how likely that is to actually come up, but it certainly has both of those things, I think, have this ambitious scope and a real chilling effect, I think, on any, especially trans people who are paying attention to them, but on really much more broadly than that as well. I know in my case, it makes me very much loath to go to Texas, where I was born and where much of my family lives, or even send, you know, let my child go to Texas. And I've, despite having not lived in Texas full time for a couple of decades, it's a different thing to feel like actually exiled, not by choice, from your home and from the place where you grew up, feeling that way, it for me really highlights the intensity of where this particular conflict has gotten us. It's a new level of intensity, right? All of us have been watching this kind of emerge slowly and then much more quickly as the kind of central focus of the right for the last 7 to 5 years, I would say. But it's a little like, you know, the old saw about frogs boiling in a pot of water or something that, you know, all of a sudden I'm realizing this is a boiling pot of water, not just a very warm one. And I think that is maybe less apparent to, you know, even to sympathetic allies, even people who, you know, feel in solidarity with trans people. I think that kind of emergent setup of conflicts, not just at this kind of culture war level, but at this level of legal conflicts, at the level of states' rights, at the level of, you know, a much broader and less concentrated kind of vigilante organization than was apparent in the Virginia rally that Jules was mentioning from long back. So that's the main thing I wanted to add there.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Care, The Highest Stage of Capitalism, by Premila Nadasen. In this eye-opening reckoning with the care economy, scholar Premila Nadasen traces its logic and history from its roots in racial capitalism and slavery to its exponential growth as a site of profit and extraction. Today's care economy, she shows, is an institutionalized, hierarchical system in which some people's pain translates into other people's profit. As Sarah Jaffe puts it, in clear and concise prose, Nadasen takes apart the care industrial complex that has emerged, like the military and prison industrial complexes before it, to wring the last drops of profit from the lives and deaths of working people. An absolutely necessary intervention in the most important political debate of our times. Find Care, The Highest Stage of Capitalism at haymarketbooks.org.
Yeah. Juliana, would you like to add to this?
Yeah, I think that point raised by Kate at the end there is really pretty crucial concerning like the personal impact which these developments, which these emergencies kind of have upon us directly. So I suppose this sort of gets us into the rather meta question of what we can gain from analyzing the far right, or if we can really gain so much from it, whether there's actually anything to observe there analytically, whether they're simply kind of sprouting whatever hateful nonsense sort of gives them opportunistic traction, or whether there's anything deeper going on there. So obviously in my opening remarks, I was sort of drawing this historical progression from the focus around like an attempt to sort of rehabilitate political worldview, anti-Semitism through this kind of nativism. So this Charlottesville protest, specifically what they were chanting was Jews will not replace us, kind of introducing this idea that the great replacement is happening and that the white majority of America is going to become a minority. And that's going to be a terrible thing because everyone knows how we treat minorities. So with that point of view, I suppose what you'd predict in that view, if you believe that the far right is opportunistic and simply has this kind of craven, compulsive hatred, which sort of latches on from one target to the next, you would think, well, the primary aim in our struggles and our political orientation should sort of be direct resistance and putting out fires and defeating these bills and electing Democrats and so on, which is, I suppose, an intuitive and a view which many people would sort of attach to. But I think the reason it is useful to scrutinize the right, and the reason it is useful to kind of try and have an analysis of where their targets appear, is not only because we can then have a predictive stance and sort of a better development of consciousness about what capitalism looks like today and where it's going to head to, but also I think because we can then sort of move beyond an analysis which frames them as the center of our politics. So specifically, when we use these terms like backlash, which is the title of this talk, or we use words like reactionary, I think that the risk for left-wing activists and the risk for socialists and communists or fellow travelers or whoever else is we introduce an agency to the far right, which it does have, which it certainly does exhibit, but we sort of trail off on the follow-through. So we say someone's a reactionary, we say there's a backlash. It's like, well, what is this backlash to? What are they reacting against? What is the reaction happening in response to? And this is sort of the question which, once you ask it and once you examine it, you start to realize that basically the issue is with the far right is it intuitively senses. It has an intuitive sense about what destabilizations or what ruptures capitalism is churning out, but it then cannot develop like a deeper, further going on understanding. So when Tucker Carlson goes on his show and he has a monologue about how he doesn't want his teenage son to be stoned and pretending to be a woman, Tucker Carlson has an obvious vision, which he can share with millions of people and find a response to. But the issue is Tucker Carlson doesn't then doesn't fully know about ordering DIY hormones or the history of marijuana and anti-Mexican racism or anything like that. And he certainly doesn't want to. So our issues is like we basically have to listen to what the far right are saying and then attempt to understand why are they concerned about the things that they are. I'll continue for a minute, that's fine. So for instance, why are they so furious about librarians? We've talked about teachers. Why are librarians this sudden hate figure of all of the people you could possibly pick in society? Suddenly there are TikTok accounts which are like posting up librarians asking children if they're they, them, and trying to get them murdered. Librarians are organizing drag queen story hours, and the Proud Boys are showing up outside and trying to storm into these protests and terrifying the parents and their children. So specifically, like, why are the far right obsessed with librarians? I don't actually think it's an irrational focus for them, is the thing. What it's about is that increasingly childcare is not something which is being done by parents. It's being done by private carers who are hired and paid by the hour. It's being done by teachers who are bringing chunks of their wages into school to feed to these children. And it's being done by these highly trained, primarily female and increasingly non-binary professionals who are highly educated, fully in tune with the latest social theorization, developmental theory, pedagogy, and so on, and unrecognized by most kind of people when they consider what the political or social landscape looks like. But the right wing intuitively identifies the importance which they have to raising the next generation and correctly perceives them as a threat to the sort of harmonious household authority structure, which has clearly been disintegrating for some time. So this is just one case in point where we can kind of start to understand when we actually look at what fascists are doing, when they consider their rhetoric and so on, we can like identify not only why they're operating, but also the things which we're able to understand and the shared understandings which we're already coming to with certain proletarian, in this case, sort of mostly state-employed workers, and why it is that so many of these towns and kind of provincial provincial villages and so on are preferring to actually close down these centers of social reproduction. Mm-hmm. So you see you see story after story about these isolated towns which are closing down one of their few childcare offering facilities rather than allowing this kind of woke ideology to continue. And the reason that they're trying to do this is because they are very important. And so anyway, I think that's why we have to begin. And there's a lot more I could say about what is actually happening and what is actually making transgender life and what is making transsexualism proliferate in the way that it is, because it's not simply a right-wing fantasy, and it's also not something which they can understand. So that's kind of my starting point. Maybe the other two can riff off that, or maybe you've got something to say, Vanessa.
Well, I feel like I'm like I have this like furrowed brow through so much of the conversation, and it is a furrowed brow of like great appreciation because I think that's such a brilliant point, and I want to follow up on that. I want to actually connect it to a point I think that Cade made earlier about conspiracism and the COVID-19 pandemic and the sort of flowering of conspiracism as this dominant mode of theorizing, if we can call it that, theorizing reality. And part of the anxiety, antipathy, hatred towards trans people is a hatred of science. I think the point, Jules, that you just made about these towns and these movements that are happy to attack educators and attack institutions of education for children. And also, I thought that your point were about how highly trained and highly, these are educators who have degrees and have studied pedagogy and have thought a lot about how to organize information and convey it right to people. Like that's what a librarian is, right? And the fact that that is, you know, that kind of practice is seen as antithetical to the practice of maintaining this kind of control that occurs through gender, in addition to many other categories, as Sandy mentioned, with race and class. But I just want to kind of invite each of you to develop that line more, because it came up in each of your comments. Just like this anti-science, anti-knowledge, anti-reality kind of core, right, to some of this anti-trans legislation and violence and rhetoric, right? This hatred of the idea that people might learn more about their bodies, and that in the process of learning about their bodies, they might actually exercise some kind of agency over their bodies and decide that they want their bodies to be organized in a way that better matches, right, what's needed for their flourishing as an individual. And the connection to that and the idea that maybe a lot of people will get that idea, and maybe they'll get the idea that they can use science to change a lot of things that are not in correlation with what actually promotes human flourishing. So I just wanted to, especially I think it's interesting that so much of the anti-trans rhetoric claims to be attacking trans people for not recognizing reality, right? While at the same time, of course, the rhetoric itself is completely unscientific. And Jules, what I love about your point is how you pointed out that this is not just a kind of debate about science that's happening at some abstract level, right? We can see that materially one side needs to destroy the systems of education and science in order to get its way, right? So I just want to, that's a big old mess, but basically what I'm asking is, you know, what about the anti-science? Okay, good. Yeah, what about hostility to science and hostility to reason and its centrality to some of these anti-trans bits of rhetoric and legislation and violence? And anybody can start. Jules, if you'd like to follow up, but as I mentioned, Cade mentioned the point about conspiracism.
I want to say, I think a very cool thing about this, which is, and it takes us back, in fact, to you raising Mumsnet in terms of where a certain kind of scientistic, right, but anti-scientific conspiracism really incubated. And that is exactly in online, not just mothers forums, but pregnancy forums, right, where people really dug in on a kind of DIY, naturalistic, natural birth concept, right, as a moral good. And, you know, it dovetailed very well with, for example, and especially in the UK, the attacks and destruction on the NHS, right? It's not just about information conveyance in terms of science. It's also about the delivery of healthcare in terms of science, right? So this came up here during the pandemic when you saw fascist vigilantes literally fighting nurses like in the street over treating COVID patients, right? This is when you say attacks on science, like that's very material one of those, right? And so the fact that this kind of incubator of like an ideology of natural motherhood and also DIY, you know, not state supported motherhood, rooted in exactly this, you know, self quote unquote research about the sort of natural completeness of the body's ability to reproduce and so forth. It's very interesting in retrospect to see actually how important that particular launching pad was for the development of what's now become this robust constellation of conspiracies theories about, you know, everything from 5G Wi-Fi to, you know, bio warfare and so forth. But which seems at first glance very incoherent, but in fact are overlapping, mutually often mutually supportive conspiracy theories that simply just have in each case a little different emphasis on exactly which thing is being most discussed, but have increasingly become more coherent, more total, and much more recognizable, I think, as a kind of coherent fascist politics than they were 5 to 7 years ago, and when they existed much more in little pieces around the internet.
Sandy or Jules?
I'm talking to Sandy.
I really like the what one thing that that Cade worded in there was describing these sort of anti-scientific movements as scientistic but not scientific, and I think, well, I say this one because I also think it's true that a lot of mainstream science, as it's understood, right, as certainly within like the academy, right, is scientistic but not scientific. You know, my last comment, I outed myself as a relatively orthodox Freudian, and within, you know, the sciences, that's not taken especially seriously a great deal of the time. And in this, you know, in exactly the relationship of science and scientism, being scientific, seeming scientific versus actually being scientific, I think it's also, I mean, we're talking a lot about teachers, librarians. We also have to talk about like actual doctors, right? And sort of the Sandy Stone point, right? The Sandy Stone point's about like you know, trans people getting access to hormones and surgeries by figuring out what they need to tell the doctors to convince those doctors that you know, I'm the right candidate, right? I fit your scientific criteria. And I think one thing that you see with far right anti-scientific conspiracism is they're in certain ways like right to look at these institutions of knowledge and authority and say, hey, that's not scientific, you're full of it, right? Right there, I agree with people who mistrust doctors, right? I agree with people who mistrust doctors and certainly people, I have plenty of mistrust of a certain kind of education, although I love learning. and within that, like, it's easy to see how without, like, or I can see the shape of how without an alternative to that, right? Without an alternative science that is actually scientific, and without I guess what I'm saying is, it's like,
I'll just say, Sandy, I don't want to cut you off. I just want to mention that I want to make sure that Juliana gets in, and I have one last question I want to ask everyone.
Yes, amazing.
So yeah, but please, by all means, finish your statement.
I'm trailing off a little, but I'm saying that the thing that we're doing is we are doing science better than the scientific authorities. Here, Jules, help me out. Help me out. Take my point home.
Yeah, why not? Okay. So I'm sure that Spectre magazine viewers are very curious about some more explicit connections that this has to Marx, who of course saw himself as doing a scientific socialism or an attempt at it. And what did that mean to Marx, and what can we do with that today? I guess that's where I'm going to take this question. And I appreciated Sandy's remarks, and especially Vanessa's kind of like teasing at this idea of like self-transformation or lability, as the 20th century sexologists would call it, the lability, the flexibility of sex and resexuation, and what we can do with that scientifically, and whether we can do anything with that. And I think we can do a lot, and I think we should. And really this question of like a scientific understanding of something which was previously taken to be more fixed or inevitable or more immutable is really sort of Marxism's origin story, its birth. So Marx's understanding of classical economics, which he had a very critical view of, but also drew all of the kind of key categories and arguments of his work in response to, was quite a profound one. And specifically with classical economics, much of what Marx saw was a kind of determinate negation, a replacement which retains something, with an earlier more agronomic, so more kind of farming focused school of economics called physiocracy. And specifically Marx drew his concept, which today we talk about a lot in terms of social reproduction. When Marx is talking about reproduction, he usually means like kind of several things at a time. He uses the term in different ways. And specifically what he calls simple reproduction. So when something replicates itself directly without expansion. This was a concept which he drew from a work called The Economic Table by François Quesnay, who was this French physiocrat thinker. And the physiocrats, at their most simple, believed that society was primarily about productive labor, which was a source of every national wealth or every national income actually came from productive labor. When I say that they were like more agronomics or more farming focused, they believed that industrial labor was kind of not superfluous, but sort of an extra add-on to society. And of course, with classical economics, this again gets flipped around. So the industrial becomes central to economic considerations, which of course is something which is distinctive about Marxists as well. We kind of believe that this industrial kind of factory set of relations is indispensable for analysis, even if it's not the only thing going on in any given society. So basically what Marx develops when he kind of takes this classical economic view is a sort of understanding of these two things operating at the same time. So why is this important for like scientific understandings of politics? Well, the reason it's important is because the people Marx was surrounded by working in London, and his sort of rivals, if you will, were these liberal thinkers who believed that you could reduce social questions down to like numerated charts, specifically around calories. So Marx's rivals were these social reformers who are sort of, in many cases, industrialists, in many cases, sort of colonial officers like John Stuart Mill, who sort of had this vision of social transformation where topics like starvation or poverty and so on could now be sort of understood scientifically and numerically, even through understanding like, oh, well, there are these people called the urban poor. And how much do the urban poor need to eat every week, how many calories do they need to consume in order to survive? So this was like a set of like scientific understandings of social problems, which Marx simultaneously understood as very pressing and vital, and saying which he needed to have a response to, but also saying which he realized was never going to appear like sufficiently, which these like liberal reformers alongside him were never really going to have complete and full and satisfying answers to. Partially because of their sort of like their lineage, their trapping in these kind of struggles of economic theory, which I was kind of briefly sketching out for you, and partly because they were colonial officers, because they were members of the bourgeoisie, they were factory owners, much like his friend Engels, who were never quite going to reach a full dialectical realization of the struggle which lay ahead. Much like his friend Engels, but that's just me being bitchy. So basically, the issue we're running into here is that, much like Marx, there are these kind of like scientific, there are these kind of like fundamentally incomplete or flawed understandings, which are offered by people like clinicians, Democratic Party functionaries, people who happily head NGO charity organizations, trying to sort of replace civil society functions for collapsing welfare states. And the people who are overseeing those collapsing welfare states, there are people who are sort of understanding the dimensions of the problem, and people who are sort of roughly appear to be on our side, appear to be against fascism and in favor of transgenderism and trans rights in a kind of liberal formation and a civic emancipatory formation, but who will never actually have the more profound, more deep, more revolutionary understanding which we're trying to achieve. So yeah, I think that's kind of like, that's sort of like that's sort of what we specifically that's what we need to kind of like consider ourselves as part of, but also at a distance from. So when we talk about like our immersion or our like defenses of science, we always have to kind of come at it with that approach I was just outlining, where we sort of look at the lineages of the kind of like so-called objective fields which we're interacting with, and we realize just like things are never actually going to break down into these nice spreadsheet charts and these nice like emancipatory quantitative tables that are going to lead us to liberation. So that's our stance on the scientific, I think.
Yeah, just quickly to add, I think maybe a little bit of historical science to this
Sorry, I was just saying, I do have one last question. I want to make sure we have time for everyone to answer. So, but yes, please.
I'll be very brief, which is just to say that precisely in practice, the kind of history of queer radicalism in the 20th century, and I think also in this one, puts on the table really exactly the I think we have to say dialectical view of science that Jules was just raising, that science can simultaneously be this process of knowledge making and world changing, right? But also that it is necessarily also a social process of doing that. And for example, if you look at ACT UP and the both the combination, right, of self community generated research, demands for research, DIY healthcare, becoming itself a source, right, of new scientific possibility in the institutional bedrock of science as a social institution, that's where you see that process that I think Jules is describing abstractly having already occurred and, of course, continuing to occur very much in trans people's attempts and successful attempts to create and access trans healthcare.
So my nemesis, the great historian of hermaphroditism, Alice Draeger, has this formation in her god-awful book, Galileo's Middle Finger, where she talks about this dichotomy between activism and science. And my key argument is always that this dichotomy has never existed. This dichotomy has never been present, ever. There has never been a clear distinction between queer, LGBT, intersex, trans activism and the sciences. You see this, as Cade has alluded to, in ACT UP, where all of the men involved in it were male registered nurses in the first round of it prior to what becomes ACT UP. The people producing these groups were either drag queens, registered nurses, or both. You see this in trans DIY communities today, where people are predominantly trained in the biological or chemical sciences. Very rarely you find autodidactic people. Mostly, again, you're looking at nurses, biological researchers. In some cases, self-taught nerds deep diving into PubMed, but definitely not people who are ignoring science, no matter what their training background may be. You see it in intersex activism, where the original group, the ISNA, the Intersex Society of North America, was launched in an editorial response to a magazine entitled The Sciences in response to Anne Fausto-Sterling and her very provocative piece about there being five sexes. Like, any way you look, you only find activists who are nerdily burrowed into the existing institutions and who don't belong into them and are usually excluded from them in tacit or more explicit ways, but who are fully immersed and kind of have this, have exactly this progression, which, like Hegel shows us in the philosophy of right, where they have been alienated through their education and are then driving this against their oppressive conditions. So anyway, I'll let you have your final question.
I wish we had like three more hours. I wanted to end the conversation with, it seems to me like one of the things that has to be denied by so much of the anti-trans rhetoric is the fact that, and I know this through osmosis, observe, just like knowing my friends, knowing each of you, like being trans is pretty cool. there's joy, right? And like self-realization. And one of the things, this question really comes from observing Cade's social media presence, actually, because Cade takes these beautiful photographs of his friends, right? And of trans nightlife and of rock shows with trans bands that Sandy's in, right? And all this stuff. And I wanted Cade to talk a little bit about that act of presentation, of preservation, of documenting, and as a participant and the importance of showing, right? If I could ask in such a abstract manner, the importance of showing, really. And so I direct that to Cade, and then I also am very interested to hear what Juliana and Sandy think about, just the importance, right, of this.
Yeah. So, one thing I would say is that I've gotten much back into taking photographs. I was very interested in that as a very young adult and stopped taking any kind of pictures or photographs on September 11th, 2001, for reasons relating to that, but also just kind of got into a space where I was doing much more academic work and so forth and not doing either that kind of artistic work or playing music, a thing I did a long time before that. And I've gotten back into both in the course of the pandemic and also in the course of beginning a medical transition. And I don't think those are kind of unrelated facts, but neither is the fun I have taking pictures of queer people for nightlife unrelated to my training as an anthropologist and ethnographer. In fact, this is one of the main tools of ethnography. But I guess what I would say is my main audience for doing that is not cis people. It's actually the people in my community. And it's in part because it's also on social media, it's very much a collaborative, iterative kind of a thing to do, right? My goal often in taking a photograph is for the person I'm photographing to see themselves, right? And to see themselves in a context, to see what they look like to me, what they look like maybe to everybody around in this particular moment, right? That's also that I'm trying to capture. And I think that process, right? That's kind of a description of a very specific milieu and experience that people have when transitioning as adults and being part of a trans community. But I think it's also just a kind of description generally of human social life, right? That we become ourselves through other people. There's an embarrassing Zulu word I'm not going to repeat for that because it's much overused, but it is also true, right? That, and very much a Marxist point, that we are most ourselves, right, through the process of being ourselves with and through other people. We develop our ideas about what kind of selves you can be exactly that way. And that, I think, is part of the explanation, right, for something Jules raised earlier of why are there so many new trans people now? I mean, I think Jules and I have been talking about that for many years. And we can talk about the family and all that, but it's also partly it becomes a self-reproducing, self-growing community of mutual recognition, development, and expansion of possibility. And being your whole self, right, becomes more possible. And by that, I don't just mean, you know, changing your gender or whatever. I also mean, like, being yourself who's a writer, but maybe also a photographer and also a musician and also, you know, a fisher by morning and and I think, you know, if we take Mark's vision seriously, it really is those parts of life that are, like, most worth living that should be the object of that vision, but are not just some distant horizon. They're actually necessarily part of the process of arriving at whatever that future society might look like. That's my answer to that question.
Thank you. Yeah. And I would love if we could have some final remarks from Juliana and Sandy. And I guess the question in a more open-ended way is about the importance of seeing and being seen, of mutual recognition, right, as Cade put it. Yeah. Jules.
Yeah, I think those glimpses, those glimpses that the social media presence get are sort of part of the answer to this question of how there are so many more trans people, how it's been, there has been this proliferating moment. Mm-hmm. But I want to pass over to Sandy. I got one more thing to say, but I'll pass over to Sandy mostly because I know she's been performing and been organizing a lot of these hardcore shows. So maybe that's
yeah. So one thing I'll say, you know, once upon a time, the nightlife, the underground, was much more underground than it is now. And it is still pretty underground, but it used to be further under. And also, there were a lot fewer trans people, and there was a much narrower range of jobs that those trans people were doing, mainly sex work, right? Very, very heavily sex work. And within that, you need photographers in that ecosystem to take pictures of you for your hooker ads, right? And then, you know, instead of why are there so many more trans people, working the other way around, there are so many more trans people, then what? All of a sudden, it becomes like kind of almost possible to imagine like making a living out of transcultural production within a trans scene for a trans audience. And then you need an Instagram, right? Then you need an Instagram. You need pictures of you there. And so it's also part of a... it's also a very important part of like a labor ecosystem of trans cultural production. And so within that, then it kind of points to like, well, to do that, right? To do that well. Right, to take those pictures well, you need to be doing the recognition, right? And it is so, yeah, you need to be doing the recognition. And so there's no way out of doing the recognition. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the joy of it, right? That's the gravedigger, right? Is that like the labor conditions of like, I'm trying to play these gigs. Hopefully I might pay my rent with them in some capacity, right? Because I have all this dead labor and making me a really good musician. I need trans community recognition, and trans community needs to recognize me because they need music, right? They need all this different kind of artistic production. And I think there's a lot, there's so much rich horizon in there and some and organizational possibility.
I love that, and I love ending on a note of the creativity and the new possibilities for human expression that are opened up by actually having a community. I'm sorry.
That's fun. No, I agree with you, Vanessa. Can I just close? I'm terrible at saying goodbye. Can I just close with maybe turning the tables for a second? So you've produced this remarkable book on Marx and morality, which I've read with great passion.
Yes.
You've also published essays on topics like Marx's irreligiousness, so his kind of like his refusal of theism, which is not even atheistic, but is sort of God disregarding morality, kind of indifferent, let's say. Mm-hmm. So often the far right is sort of focused around, if not Christianity, then at least some kind of moral appeal or some notion of society's degeneration, its decay, its collapse. So as people who want to radically transform, overturn, and abolish all sorts of different parts of society, what should we do as Marxists kind of in reply to that? What do you think is the best move for responding to moralists? What's our side of this argument?
The moral argument in that case being something like not adhering to binary cisgenders inherently degenerate, or is that the
capitalism is generating moral collapse and alienation in the Heideggerian sense rather than the Marxist sense that this technology is an onslaught that is making us fall to pieces and so on. So how do we reply to this kind of half-hearted critique of capital? Contribution as Marxists? What can we do?
And just briefly, because we're going to wrap up in a moment, but just briefly, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is to say, like, there is a degeneration of of these social categories. There is a destructive element that capitalism plays in ripping up the material basis of these static eternal forms of or what we're taken to be anyway, these static eternal forms of social life that all human social existence must find itself contained within. That they're not wrong. Like, I mean, making a similar kind of move to the one that you beautifully made with respect to the targeting of educators, right? And it's true. But it's a kind of stodgy, stultifying, suffocating system of attempting to compress all the different ways that people exist as gendered and sexed and as having sexuality and all of these things, trying to compress them into this form that is, first of all, it's self-historical, historically emergent. Like, we can point to specific times that these categories of cis heterosexual manhood and cis heterosexual womanhood emerge, and in much of the world they emerge really late with colonialism, right, and with attempts to stamp out other ways of organizing human life. And so we can point that out and point out that just as this is a kind of set of categories that has that emerges at a particular moment in time, it's one that can pass away in the course of history, and that should be helped along in that. What is it that trans people and trans rights and allies of trans people are accused of destroying, while they're accused of destroying traditional gender. Well, that's true, right? But also, why is that supposed to matter? Because somehow it's going to lead to the well, the big thing is the groomer thing, right? Somehow this has to do with the children, and it's all about protecting the purity and sanctity of children. But oftentimes the people making these arguments are the same ones who sexualize children in really creepy and bizarre ways. And so on that level, it's just disingenuous. It's just obvious that they're lying and don't care. And so all of that, I feel like was very, all of that is, I wasn't expecting to answer any questions.
So, I love being non-hierarchical.
Exactly. Non-hierarchical. So I feel like all of that is very, off the top of the dome here, but mm-hmm. that's the kind of move that I would be inclined to develop. Right. Yeah. Thank you. So with that, I want to thank our speakers again for being with us for this hour. And I want to tell our viewers that if you wish that you could continue this conversation with us, as I do, you can. So you can become monthly donors to Spectre. And as a monthly donor to Spectre Journal, you will receive an invitation for a discussion with us on Zoom, and you'll have an opportunity to talk back and to raise all sorts of additional questions for us so that we can continue this conversation. I learned so much and benefited so much from being part of this, and I really thank each of you for being with us today.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.